Well, good to see everyone. Hope you enjoy the message today because it's going to be a little different than what we sometimes do. But there are many things in the New Testament that we would consider to be very enigmatic. In other words, it's hard to be sure exactly what it's talking about. One of those areas we find in Revelation chapter 7 and again in 14, where we're introduced to a group of people. We know them as the 144,000. Now, over the years, I've heard many, many attempts to explain who these people are. And it's really all over the map. Some have posed that there's two completely separate groups of 144,000 because it's mentioned in two different places and there's a slight difference between the two. Another common take on it, and I've heard this in evangelical churches as well, that these 144,000 people are all alive at the time of the second coming, which is interesting. I recall some time ago hearing the JWs get all excited because their membership was hovering around that number, and they thought, well, this must be a sign that things are about to happen. Well, we had a similar experience in our own group when our feast attendees got up over 150,000, and we had sort of the same ideas, you know, maybe that. Well, that is based on the idea that those people who are in this group are all alive at the time of Christ's second coming. Now, there's evidence that would suggest otherwise, but we'll get there. Another idea is that this group of people is the entirety of the converted people from all time. In other words, that's all that were ever converted. And, you know, we balk at that because it's such an absurdly small number. That couldn't possibly be. But it's an idea that some people have, that this is the entirety of the first resurrection. The other idea is that these are members of just one particular religious group. And then we have the problem with that one religious group that we tend to identify with has split again and again over the last few decades. Now what? Because now we have to entertain a different idea. The other idea that I've heard is that it comprises the entirety of the bride of Christ. Now, there's a problem with that, and we'll come to it. I'm going to pose to you a little different idea today that hopefully it'll be a little more comprehensive, that these 144,000 are a select group from within the people who have been converted over all time. Who are these people? And more importantly, what is their assignment? It tells us. You've heard the expression, and it's not necessarily referring to a jury trial necessarily, but you've heard the expression, the jury is out. Now, we know what that means is we've got some information, and we haven't come to a firm conclusion on that yet. We have to examine the evidence. I want us to be the jury on this. We're going to go through the scriptures on the subject, and let's review the evidence, and let's apply what we know, assessing what's clear about that evidence. For the moment, let's set aside any prior interpretations of that evidence that we may have entertained. I would like us to look at the matter again with a fresh point of view. Now, let's understand something. This is not something that's trivial. We may say, oh, that's not a salvational issue, really. Well, true, it isn't. But it's also sufficiently important that Jesus Christ told us specifically about these people, and not just once, but twice. Okay? He wants us to know something. The account of these people describes something we ought to know. It makes us aware that if we don't know, if we don't have an answer, that there's something we need to look into. The question is, who among us, or perhaps all of us, are included in that number? We'd like to think so, but that's number one question. Are you a part of that particular group? I was listening to a bunch of hymns online last night. Sometimes I do that on a Sabbath evening. I'll just go on YouTube, and they have these compilations of hymns that are continuous for several hours sometimes. But I'm listening to a number of hymns, maybe a half hour's worth or so. And I began to realize that those people who make these old favorite hymns are clueless in one important area of the New Testament. Now, there's a clue to that area we find in Matthew 19, verse 28. And there's a repeat of it in another one of the Gospels. But let's go to Matthew 19 and verse 28. I'm going to start in verse 27. Then answered Peter and said unto him, Behold, we have forsaken all and followed you. What shall we have therefore? And Jesus said unto them, Truly I say unto you that you which have followed me in the regeneration, when the Son of Man shall sit on the throne of his glory, you also shall sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. A simple little sentence, but it opens up a whole world of awareness that there is going to be a government of God on earth, and he's telling us, at least at the top echelon, how it's going to be organized, how it's going to be administered. Most religions are clueless about the fact of the millennial kingdom on earth. It's not in their realm of interest, it seems. You wonder why, but it's true. There are people, and there have been people who've attended with us, who don't realize that there's going to be 1,000 years of Christ's government over all nations here on the earth. That is a big realization. But it's with that awareness that we can begin to understand the 144,000. Now, why some people suggest that maybe there's two different groups is because we're introduced to them in two different chapters. However, let me point out something here. In chapter 7, we're looking at the inclusion or the development of this group prior to the second coming. In chapter 14, we see them after the second coming. So there is a period of time when these 144,000 are being brought together, prepared for the assignment that they're going to be given. So chapter 7 is now, basically. Chapter 14 is after the second coming. And once we realize that, then the idea that there needs to be two different groups is really unnecessary. They're the same. The question is, how does this apply to God's called out ones? It's really a huge question because we've got that problem where the number is too small for our senses to grasp that that could ever be the entirety of those called since the time of Christ. The number has got to be vastly greater than that. And that would tend to make some people think, well, then maybe it's just those alive at that time. That is a more comprehensible number, I suppose. But then we've got another problem. It's an ethnic problem. Because he's selecting 12,000 out of each of the 12 tribes of Israel. Where does that leave the rest of the world? The tribes of Israel are just a minority in the overall population of the world. What's that tell us? It involves just one ethnic group, and it involves the administration of just one ethnic group. Now, in that alone, we have a piece of information that we need to process. Why? Just that small number, 12,000, each apparently under one of the 12 apostles that we read of in Matthew 19. Why just that number? And why just administer one nation? Well, from what we know, it was God's intent that the nation of Israel be his model nation for bringing salvation to the rest of the world. That gives us an answer as to why just them. Israel is the nation that God is going to purify and use to bring true salvation to the rest of the world. There's a passage in, I'm out of order here, but let's go to Zechariah chapter 8, verse 23. I'll read it. It says, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, in those days," I mean, you can't say this now of these people, but "in those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold out of all languages of the nations, even shall take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, we will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you." That prophecy is clearly after Christ's second coming. And the nation of Israel, the nations of Israel, have been brought into a correct worship of God. They are going to be used to bring salvation to the rest of the world. Now reflect back. If the 144,000 are from and to each of these 12 tribes of Israel, number one, it tells us God knows where these nations are. We may not, but he knows. But he selects of their ethnicity to administer to their ethnicity. And that will be how God achieves his purpose for having chosen Israel in the first place, for a job. Not choosing them because they're better. Not choosing them because they're great necessarily. I mean, he's blessed them greatly to foster his plan, perhaps. But they're no better than anybody else, really. But he's going to use them. to bring salvation to the rest of the world. Now, that gives us a clue as to who these people are then. The 144,000 are the administration of the nation of Israel. Now, back to the earlier question. What about the rest of the world? What about all the other ethnicities? Well, they have their called, chosen, and faithful among themselves, and they will probably have some similar administration. But that's not the point of this passage. Like example, if we go back to Ezekiel 37, the Valley of Dry Bones, where he describes a physical resurrection of the whole house of Israel. Now, does that tell us that just the whole house of Israel will be resurrected in the second resurrection? Obviously, no. But why is he just talking about them? Because they are the focal nation that he's dealing with. We can interpolate the fact that other nationalities will experience the same thing, but he's not dealing with them in this manner. That's the point to realize. So that when we come to the 144,000, same thing. This is not the entirety of all of the people converted. It's just the select group from within that number who he is going to assign to administer the nations of Israel under his rule. So with that understanding, we can begin to realize who they are and why the number is what it is. 12,000 to each, 12 tribes. It's a common number in God's plan and his works to do something like that. So it's important in that respect as well. It shows a specialness, that's all. It shows a specialness. Let's read the narrative now with that background. What it says about the 144,000. I'm going to begin in Revelation chapter 7, verse 1. And after these things, I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, nor on the sea, nor on any tree. And I saw another great angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God. And he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was given to hurt the earth and the sea, saying, "Hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads." And I heard the number of them which were sealed. And there were sealed 144,000 of all of the tribes of the children of Israel. And it goes on to list each of the tribes. Now, it's interesting that those tribes are identified out of order. This is not their birth order. This is different. And one of those tribes is a grandson. And another one is missing. Interesting. There's many people who have speculated as to why that is. I'm not going to do that now, but it's just interesting because I think it tells us that this order reveals the fact that there is a change, some kind of change in mind here, to have a different order. The tribe of Judah, that was the fourth born. Reuben was the firstborn. Gad was the seventhborn, son of one of the handmaidens. Asher was the eighth, same handmaiden. Naphtali was the sixthborn, another son of a handmaiden Bilhah. Manasseh was the 11th born of Rachel, and was one of the grandsons. So on and on it goes that there are questions about the order. But I'm sure God has his reasons for that order. Now, another interesting point here is, and I mentioned earlier, that Revelation 7 is an account of these people before the second coming. And it talks about them being sealed. Verse 3, hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads. The scene that we see in Revelation 7 is during a period of time when the sealing is going on. These aren't people who are just becoming converted. These are people who are being finalized in that process. Now, what does sealing amount to? Let's go to 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 21. Now, he which establishes us with you in Christ and hath anointed us is God, who has sealed us and given the earnest of the Spirit in our hearts. So that sealing involves being given God's Spirit, John 6:27. Labor not for that meat which perishes, but for that meat which endures unto everlasting life, which the Son of Man shall give unto you, for him has God the Father sealed. The sealing is an important component of being prepared for membership in God's family. Ephesians 1:13. Verse 12, that we should be to the praise of his glory, who first trusted in Christ, in whom you also trusted, after that you heard the word of truth, the gospel of your salvation, in whom also, after that you believed, after that you believed, you were sealed with that Holy Spirit of promise. Let's go to Ephesians 4:30. And grieve not the Holy Spirit of God, whereby you are sealed unto the day of redemption. So when the angel is instructed to hold back events until the sealing process is completed, that tells us that it's an ongoing process, that people are being prepared for this assignment that God has for them. What does the sealing accomplish? It's for a task. It's not necessarily for protection. There's people who interpret that particular passage to think that it exempts the sealed from tribulation. I don't know that it says that. Let's look at what it says. Hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads. That's Revelation 7:3. Does that really tell us that they're exempt from tribulation? Or just telling us that they are finalized for their assignment when the day comes? People sometimes read into it things that aren't necessarily there. Now, we've also got the problem that we read of in Revelation 6, where there are the martyrs whose souls are held under the altar, crying out, how long? How much longer do we have to wait? And he says to them, until your brethren are martyred as you were. So we've got people in the end time. There is going to be an end time martyrdom of saints. We know that. And it's not really a surprise, considering world conditions and considering the prophecies of how things are going to play out. But there are going to be people in the end time who are not protected. They're going to be given the opportunity to exhibit their faith in a very spectacular way. And they're spoken of very commendably to these who have already been martyred. So the end-time martyrdom of saints would contradict the idea that these people sealed are protected. Not necessarily. It's just that they are finalized for the assignment that they're going to be given. I could mention the idea that exists in the evangelical world of the rapture. I think we can see how that would conflict with what's being talked here. That creates its own dilemma. The rapture is seen as a removal from exposure to tribulation. It's the evangelical's place of safety idea, which we can relate to, I suppose. But the sealing is accomplished before the judgment of God commences. That's all it's saying. So there's a point in time where there's a cutoff. Once this sealing process for these is complete, that's not saying no one ever will ever be converted after that point in time. It's just saying the sealing for this group of people is complete and finalized before God intervenes with his judgments, as are described in many prophecies. But what is their assignment? It isn't just conversion. It isn't just being, you know, brought into the family of God per se. There's an extra assignment here. Their assignment is to be the administration of the peoples of Israel. That's the difference. In other words, out of the overall number of people who have ever been converted, there will be this echelon from within whom God is selecting for whatever reason he has. He knows the talents that he's invested in people, and he knows what they're going to do with those talents because he's seen it demonstrated. And he is going to select that number out from among the entirety of the converted genre from all time. I don't believe, personally, that the 144,000 are all living at the time of Christ's second coming. In fact, I would say many are from past ages are far more exemplary than people in our generation. It would include those who are resurrected as well, I'm sure. But now another thing to consider, and this throws people at times. These are not all Jews. The world doesn't recognize the distinction necessarily. They identify Jews distinctly and separately of other ethnicities, not realizing that 10 of the tribes are not, never were, Jews per se. They're Israelites. We understand that. But the world does not. The 144,000 are going to be used by God in a spectacular way. It says of them in chapter 14. Let's go there. Chapter 14 is a scene that is clearly after the second coming, whereas chapter 7 is not. But he says, "And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on the Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his father's name written in their foreheads." His father's name written in their foreheads. "And I heard a voice from heaven, as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of a great thunder. And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their lamp, with their harps. And they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders. And no man could learn that song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth. Now that's a curious passage. No man could learn that song. 144,000 that were redeemed from the earth. So we know where they come from. But the start of verse 3, it says, and they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne and before the four beasts. Where is that? Think about it. Now, in an earlier message where we talked about the bride of Christ, it was posed that, quite possibly, the marriage of the bride will take place in heaven. This sort of dovetails with that idea, does it not? These are they, it says in verse 4, which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. And that's talking spiritually. These are they which follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. We know who the first fruits were. And we know that the first fruits includes the people from the earliest generations. Verse 5, and in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. Reflecting back on the sealing idea, this helps us understand that term a little better. They are without fault before the throne of God. God is working a purification process on these individuals that he is going to select for a very high calling. Not to diminish conversion in general, but there is a specific genre that God is working with, that he is going to use to administer his government directly under him, under the apostles, over the entirety of the rest of the world. This is what the religious community of our time doesn't get. They don't understand this. And until you understand that, you can't begin to understand who the 144,000 are or what their calling is. That's the important thing. It has to do with the government of God on earth. So what about the rest of the world? What about the rest from among our own ethnicity who aren't necessarily in this select group? Doesn't diminish their conversion one bit. It just gives them a different place in the structure of the world government of that time. That's all. There are many, many converted people who aren't necessarily in this small, select group from within it. And keep in mind, we have to consider the converted people of all time, not just the modern age. I wouldn't say much positive about the modern age, to be honest with you. We know what Laodicea is. We know what part that plays. We know what that tells us. Very likely, the most devoted, dedicated, accomplished, converted people from all time have lived in times of great stress. And they have proved themselves under conditions that we might really not do well under. Let's appreciate what we're given, the atmosphere in the world today. The opportunity, I mean, to stand here and speak freely. There's many places in the world you can't do that. You can't. Look at the freedom that we have. Let's appreciate that. However, let's not be lax. There is a calling. There is a high calling. There is an even higher calling of those people that God will find useful in His plan. And we should aspire to be that ourselves. I think I've covered most of the rest of my notes in one place or another, so I think that's about all I have. But let's understand that these are not just our church group. These are not all who were ever converted. These are not other ethnicities besides Israel. This is a select group. God knows who He's going to select and why. But He has a great purpose for them, to rule with Him, to be refined religiously, and to bring this world into a knowledge of God's truth that it does not presently have any idea about. God has a plan, and these 144,000 individuals are part of that plan. He's told us about it. It's informational, but in a way, it's a warning, too, that we shouldn't slack off in our dedication, in our application, and the development of the faith that it takes to be called and chosen and ultimately faithful. So let me leave that a question that we started with. Are you, are we included in that number?